Bom dia a todos.
Good morning, everyone. We have a simultaneous interpretation in two different languages. I'm delighted to start this meeting. First of all, I would like to greet the Madam President of the Legislative Assembly of the Autonomous Region of Madeira, who honors us with her presence, the members of Parliament for the electoral circle of Madeira, who were invited to be with us, some members of Parliament that join us in this opening session, and also the speakers who are going to tell us about the topics that we are addressing at this committee meeting. I will have to speak more slowly because of interpretation. We are at the House of Democracy of the Autonomous Region, and we have with us the president of this a legislative assembly that ensures the importance of the autonomous region of Madeira. In a century-old building, a very important building such as this one, who used a building that used to be the customs office of the autonomous region of Madeira. And therefore, I'll give immediately the floor to Madam President Rubina Leal, someone that I have known for many years, and I would like to thank her for the fact that we are hosting this meeting of the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water here in the Autonomous Region, also due to the will of Madam President. So on behalf of Portugal and on behalf of the Parliamentary Assembly, thank you for having us here today. Thank you very much. Good morning to all those who have joined this meeting. Let me start by greeting the President of the Committee on Energy, Environment, and Water of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Union for the Mediterranean. And through him, I would like to greet everyone who is represented here at this meeting. Also, the members of the European Parliament, namely Paulo Nascimento Cabral, MEP, our friend from the Azores Islands. I would like to thank you very much for being here. Madam President of the Portuguese Parliament, Vania, who I've known for a long time. Member of the Legislative Assembly of Madeira, and other members of the delegations of the different countries, ladies and gentlemen. Allow me, first of all, to welcome you to this Parliament in a particularly important year for us. We celebrate the 50th anniversary of our autonomy, our democracy, and we want to celebrate this 50th anniversary, and we are indeed delighted to host you here, to welcome you here in the venue where we produce legislation, where we supervise the government's actions. And above all, this is a space where we exercise democracy in such a turmoiled world as the one we are living in today, a moment when a lot can be at stake. And so this parliament is very relevant. It was something that we conquered. The population of Madeira and the Azores yearned for this for a long time. And after 50 years, we can say that we are autonomous. But we want to make this autonomy even deeper. I would also like to say that we are honored to host this meeting of the committee. Allow me as well to congratulate Portugal on its presidency of this committee since September 2020, highlighting our country's firm commitment to major challenges such as the environment, energy, and climate. These challenges, which are pressing for the Euro-Mediterranean region, are increasingly global, interconnected, and urgent. We live in a time when pressure on natural resources, the accelerated biodiversity loss, and the impacts of climate change demand responsible political responses based on scientific knowledge and anchored in effective international cooperation. And I think that this is why it is so important for us to have good effects of the policies developed. And we can do that if we have international cooperation. Otherwise, the objectives will not be achieved. Either everyone commits to responding to these challenges, or the efforts of some countries will most likely be in vain. We can safely say, now I'm talking about the region, we can say that this part of the Portuguese territory, the autonomous region of Madeira, assumes and complies with the goals and objectives set by national and international institutions. It is precisely in this context that our region plays a role that deserves to be highlighted. Madeira is indeed of unique geostrategic importance to Portugal, just like the Azores, clearly affirming its Atlantic dimension. Located at the crossroads of sea and air routes, the region is a true Atlantic platform, projecting Portugal out into the ocean and reinforcing its strategic centrality both in the Euro-Atlantic area and in its natural connection to the Mediterranean. And I think this is a huge added value that we are proud of, the fact that we project the country into the sea. But we also have another very important aspect, the fact that we project it into our communities. We are much more abroad than we are here. And that increases not only our territory, but also our dimension, the Portugal nature, our customs, our values, which are at the basis of our essence as a people. This position gives us increased responsibilities, but also unique opportunities, particularly in the environmental, scientific, and energy fields. But the autonomous region of Madeira goes far beyond its geostrategic location. It is, above all, a territory where the environment is a cornerstone of regional identity, the economy, and of the development model. We are talking about a region that is home to ecosystems that are unique in the world, many of which are internationally recognized for their exceptional value. I would like to highlight, first and foremost, the Laurel Forest of Madeira, classified as World Natural Heritage Site by UNESCO. I think that yesterday some of you had the opportunity to get to know our Laurel Forest. And I'm certain that it allows the members of this committee to experience this living reality firsthand, where nature, science, and public policy intersect in an inadequate manner. It's also important to highlight that the autonomous region of Madeira has the largest fully protected marine area in Europe and the North Atlantic, the Selvagens Island Nature Reserve. This protected territory is a true sanctuary for wildlife, especially marine life, and is now an international benchmark for nature conservation and ocean protection. And it is precisely at this point that it is important to highlight the central importance of the sea to our island. The ocean is an inseparable part of our identity, our history, and our strategic projection. But it is also most likely a limitation. It is in the sea that a fundamental part of our biodiversity, our economy, and also our future can be found. The vast exclusive economic zone and the Portuguese responsibility, strongly marked by the Atlantic dimension of Madeira, constitutes a natural heritage of enormous environmental, scientific, and geopolitical value. The protection of marine ecosystems, the sustainable management of ocean resources, and the fight against marine pollution are absolute priorities for us. The region's marine protected areas, particularly the Selvagem Islands, as I've mentioned before, demonstrate that it is possible to preserve the ocean while promoting scientific knowledge, international cooperation, and sustainable development. This integrated view of the territory naturally extends to water management, and water is perhaps the most precious resource that we have. In a mountainous region like ours, with rugged terrain and marked by great climatic variability, today we can still see the sun. I don't believe, but our climate truly varies over the day. Water has always required ingenuity, planning, and respect. One of the most notable examples of this human ability to adapt to nature is the levadas of Madeira, our water channels, a centuries-old hydraulic system unique in the world, which allows water to be collected, transported, and distributed throughout the island, ensuring agriculture, supplying the population, and maintaining the balance of ecosystems. The levadas, these channels, are much more than infrastructure. They are cultural, environmental, and technological heritage, illustrating how traditional knowledge, how human strength, because this was all made by hand by our engineers and our workers at the time who worked in the mountains, so illustrating this heritage and show how traditional knowledge can offer sustainable and resilient responses to contemporary challenges of water scarcity. Another example is the case of Porto Santo, an island nearby, which is part of our archipelago. And there, the reality has always been different. It is an island where fresh water has historically been a scarce commodity, limiting population growth and economic development. It was this limitation that led to an innovative solution, the construction in 1980 of Portugal's first desalination plant using a reverse osmosis system, which was an innovative solution at the time and which still exists today and is the source of drinking water in the island of Porto Santo, transforming seawater into potable water. This pioneering initiative has mitigated a structural problem, ensuring water security for the population and promoting a more balanced development without compromising the island's fragile ecosystems. But ladies and gentlemen, speaking of sustainability, I must address the issue of energy, one of the central themes of this committee. The autonomous region of Madeira has made a strong and consistent investment in renewable energies, exploiting them responsibly. This strategy is a choice for resilience, autonomy, and a vision for the future. Proof of this was clearly evident recently when a blackout affected mainland Portugal last year. Madeira, thanks to its energy self-sufficiency, was not affected in any way, demonstrating that energy transition is also a matter of security, stability, and sovereignty. Reducing reliance on fossil fuels, cutting emissions, protecting the environment, and ensuring energy independence are not contradictory goals. They are integral parts of the same sustainable development strategy, which must coexist. It is therefore possible to reconcile environmental protection, economic development, and social cohesion, even in island territories like ours, a distant island, particularly exposed to the effects of climate change. In an area as diverse as the Mediterranean and its natural connection to the Atlantic, this committee plays a decisive role in developing common policies that protect wildlife, halt the degradation of ecosystems, and ensure a sustainable future for the next generations. But above all, that enable international cooperation among all. May this meeting be another firm step along this path, strengthening political dialogue, scientific cooperation, and the sharing of best practices. I hope that this work session is a fruitful one for us to reach all goals for the benefit of our territories, our populations, Europe, and the Mediterranean. Thank you very much.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much, Madam President. It was an honor to hear your wise and deep words, not only on the topic that we are going to discuss here and the parallel between the Atlantic and the Mediterranean, but also your detailed description of the potential of the autonomous region of Madeira, which is, for all of us, a mission. And you focus on the topic of our session, which is protecting wildlife and mitigating the degradation of terrestrial and marine ecosystems in the Mediterranean region. We will have contributions by Nuno Caiola, a researcher at the Climate Resilience Center and at the Department of Climate Change of the Technology Center of Catalonia, and he's Portuguese. Dr. Yaneia Penka, Senior Research Associate, Head of the Mediterranean Institute for Environmental Studies at the Science and Research Center, COPAR. Thank you for being here. And also, not from the Mediterranean region, but from the Atlantic region, from the autonomous region, Ms. Pedro Sepulveda, the Director of Climate Action and Sustainability Services at the Regional Directorate for the Environment and the Sea. Madam President, I know that you have your own agenda, but we would like to take the advantage that you are here to take a group picture. So we would make a short interruption in our session here to take a group picture, because our member from Algeria will also have to leave earlier, and so we will take this picture now. I would also like to tell you that we have represented in this meeting Portugal through myself as the president of the Committee Energy. We have members from Algeria, Mohamed Tahar Belalf. We also have the presence of Morocco, who is going to chair the Parliamentary Assembly next year. We have the Member of Parliament Fatima Yassin from Morocco and Rabab Aylal, who are here with us from Cyprus. Member of Parliament Averof Neofitu from Montenegro, Member of Parliament Gordon Stojovic from Bulgaria, Kirill Dobrev to our left hand side, from Turkey, Mustafa Cevicioglu, and the president of the Committee on Economic, Financial, and Social and Education Affairs, Samil Ayrim, and the members of the European Parliament, Jadwiga Wisniewska, and, as Madam President mentioned before, also from Portugal, from the autonomous regions, in this case the Azores, my dear friend, MEP Paulo Nascimento Cabral. So this is the Committee on Energy, Environment and Water. And so we will now make a short break to take the picture. But before that, on behalf of the committee and on behalf of the Portuguese Parliament, I would like to give Madam President a token of our appreciation.
Muito bem, é com grande satisfação que iniciamos então.
So we are delighted to start our work session of the Committee on Energy, Environment and Water. I've already introduced all the members of the committee and of the Parliamentary Assembly, and we are delighted to host this meeting in the autonomous region of Madeira, an island region which is very beautiful given its natural landscape that yesterday we had the opportunity to visit and to get to know, especially the Laurel Forest, which is a UNESCO World Heritage. This is a region that has a commitment towards preserving biodiversity and environmental stewardship, a responsible environmental stewardship, and that moves us all as members of the Committee on Environment. Although this island is in the Atlantic Ocean and not in the Mediterranean, we share with the Mediterranean similar challenges in protecting wildlife and preserving fragile ecosystems. The region is experienced in nature conservation and protected marine areas, and it offers us a context of significant inspiration for our meeting. This is precisely the topic of our meeting, protecting wildlife and biodiversity and ecosystems. We have an agenda that you have all received, that it's an agenda that I propose, but it needs to be ratified in the meeting. And therefore, I would like us to adopt the agenda if you so consider. Anyone has anything against? If that's not the case, we will adopt the agenda. The following item is the approval of the minutes of the previous meeting that took place in the month of November in Cairo, Egypt. The minutes have been circulated by all members, and it is at the reception. If you haven't received it electronically, you can have it on paper. Can we approve the minutes of the previous meeting? Anyone has anything to add or to propose as amendment? Is it okay? So we can see any abstentions, any votes against. Therefore, the minutes of the previous meeting have been approved unanimously. As I said before, we have with us three experts that are going to give us their contribution on protecting wildlife and addressing the degradation of terrestrial and marine ecosystems. And we are very honored for their presence here in our meeting. So we will have now a thematic moment. After that, there will be a coffee break. And after the coffee break, we will have interventions by members of the Parliamentary Assembly Committee members. So I'll give the floor now to Nuno Caiola. As I said before, he's a a Portuguese researcher at the Climate Resilience Center and at the Department of Climate Change of the Technology Center of Catalonia in Spain, ERCAT. Thank you for accepting the invitation to join us, and I'll give you the floor immediately. I don't know if you want to stand at the podium. You have the floor. Thank you.
Muito obrigado. Em primeiro lugar, quero agradecer. I don't know if to do this in English or in Portuguese. You get the
So in this first part, I would like to thank the Parliamentary Assembly and the committee for having invited me. It's a great honor to be here. It's an honor to have been asked to explain how I have contributed to this field of regarding adaptation to climate change and the importance of environmental restoration for such an adaptation, and also for mitigating the effects of climate change in the Mediterranean coastal areas. So before I start my presentation, I would like to thank specifically Eduardo Teixeira and also Josefina and Katia. Thank you. You were great in organizing this, and I'm very thankful to you. So now I think I can continue. So you can see here the topic of my presentation, which is in English. I think that it's easier for everyone involved to follow my presentation. So I'm going to be talking on the importance of restoration of ecosystems of the Mediterranean coasts. And I'm going to say how important it is to have that strategy so that we can be more resilient for the effects or to the effects of climate change that are unstoppable, of course. So now I would like to start by talking about the decade where we are. We are in the middle of the decade for the United Nations regarding the adaptation and the ecosystem restoration. And so if we want to work with nature and not against nature, we need to adapt to the big challenges ahead, mainly climate change, but also the loss of biodiversity. So if we want to work with nature, we realize that currently we do not have enough ecosystems that are wealthy enough to follow that strategy. And so we must conduct environmental restoration. Only through that can we achieve to have a surface area that is wide enough in good health, so that those ecosystems can provide us with some services that will allow us to fight and to adapt to climate change. So having understood that, the United Nations have decided that this is the decade for environmental restoration. So we have goals and objectives to restore ecosystems until 2030. That is something that the European Union also wants to achieve, and that is why we have the Green Deal, which is also a part of this vision. It shares this idea that we need to have a wider area of ecosystems that are healthy. And so the European Union has allocated funds to research in this area. One of the instruments that they have for research in this field are the different programs. The previous one, D plus T, which was Horizon 2020, and now the newest one, which is Horizon Europe. And so I'm going to tell you a little bit about a European project, which is REST Coast, which is an acronym for the title of this project, which is Large-Scale Restoration of Coastal Ecosystems Through Rivers to Sea Connectivity. And that is something that was in Horizon 2020. So we want to restore ecosystems in a large scale. So what are the objectives? This project started 5 years ago. It's due to finish in May 2026. And so the biggest objective was to do the scaling up of ecosystem restoration. How did we do that? We identified barriers, but we also have identified enablers. We did that at a technical level, so technical aspects of restoration itself, so techniques and methods to restore the different types of ecosystems. But we also looked at that through the financial scope and the governance scope. This is how we tried to approach this issue. With these three pillars, we then tried to see what would be the best way to assess if the work that is being done correctly. And that is why we have developed a series of indicators to assess if the protection of biodiversity and the systemic services that we were doing were being well carried out for environmental restoration. So we have worked in several points of the European coastlines. You can see them here in this diagram and this map. We have a lot of pilot sites that are set in the Mediterranean, in Spain, France, two in Italy, and also in the Dark Sea. We have other points that are not from the Mediterranean, but that also have some problems and pose their own problems. And if you look at this map, you can see that we have distributed the pilot sites in a specific way. And you may ask, why is the Mediterranean overrepresented here? Because we have 8 pilot sites, and 4 of them are in the Mediterranean and 1 in the Dark Sea. And why is that? Because it is the climate hotspot. A lot of the things that are connected to climate change are in the Mediterranean. Mediterranean is very vulnerable to climate change, not only regarding the temperature, but also regarding other aspects that stem from climate change. So, namely, the rise in the sea level. You can see here in this diagram that is a diagram that is is from the IPCC sixth assessment report, and we can see in different areas or regions of the Mediterranean, we can see data from temperature, but not only data that has been collected, but also the projections for the future. And we can see it very clearly in the temperature, the precipitation, and also in extreme events. Events for a long-term dry conditions. And so we can also see that the level of the sea is rising in the Mediterranean and in the coastal areas that are low altitude, for instance, in the different deltas. I work in the Ebro Delta, but we have other deltas that are very important in the Mediterranean, such as the Nile Delta. And those are regions that are very vulnerable to the rise of the sea level. And that rise can affect a lot of regions. And it affects them at the ecological level, at the biodiversity level, but also in terms of economy and people's way of life. Of course, we also see some secondary effects. We see the loss of very important areas that are very important for biodiversity. So the loss of wetlands is a big problem. And those regions are fundamental for us to be able to adapt to climate change. They are also very important to defend us against the severe events. And in these areas, we need a horizontal protection so that when the storms reach the land, they can reduce their strengths, because we have these ecosystems that allow us to do that. And you can see in this map that I have here, this is from an article that we published last year. And we can see here that we are at a risk of losing 50% or more of these coastal wetlands in the Mediterranean. And if we don't do anything about that, is a big problem. That is why restoration is so important. So the project's objective is also to see the change in paradigm, to go from business as usual. So we have a strategy that is based on hard construction, hard protection. So the gray solutions, as they are called, so as seawalls that are artificial constructions in the coastland that attack the symptoms, but they do not affect the causes of these symptoms. And they are not very effective, and they are very expensive because they need to be continuously maintained. And so what we wanted to do with our project was to give the scientific reasons to have a change, a shift in the paradigm. And the idea is to take advantage of the coastal systems and working with them for adaptation to climate change. As you can see here, we want to go from protecting a fixed line in the coastal area to manage a dynamic system. We don't want to fight nature, but we want to take advantage of nature so that we can adapt to this new reality. We also have adaptive landscapes that we want to create. So we are trying to move from a strategy that is very fixed and very gray to another strategy that is more sustainable for the future up until the end of this century, long-term resilience. I don't know how I am in terms of time, but I think I'm not running late. So I can give you some examples of what we have done in this project. At the left-hand side of the screen, you can see a site which is not in the Mediterranean. It is in the Waddenzee Sea, in the Netherlands. And what we see is that the Netherlands have themselves now trying, they are trying to move away from the dikes and try to adapt to the new weather, and also to mitigate the effects of climate change, because these, if the systems, the ecosystems are healthy, they can be very effective in capturing, catching carbon. And so we, you can see here another example in the Rhône Delta in France. And the French colleagues have been working in strategies of passive restoration. What is that? It's stepping back and allowing the ecological systems to work so that nature can create its own regeneration in the coastal area. This is very important for the coastal systems that are very dynamic and very fluctuating. And so this is what they are doing there. We have also tried, and we did, a database with more than 500 observation of projects of coastal restoration. And it's very important to have this database because we can see the several examples of the types of restoration, not just in terms of the techniques used, but also financial aspects and governance aspects. And from those observations, we can see which ones are good practices that have worked well, and we can also see which of those sites and projects didn't work as well and need to be improved. This is an European project that is paid for by taxpayers, and so everything that is generated here is free, so it's very important for us to share with the scientific community all of the information that stems from this project, so that the scientific community can use those data to design new projects and new responses. Here you can see the type of information that we have in the coastal restoration database. We have the site ID and location, the ecosystem type, the habitats and land use, the habitats and the land use change, all of the restoration techniques, the monitoring. Everybody can consult this database at the end of this project. So in a few months' time, it will be available on the Commission portal. As I said before, we also developed a lot of indicators so that we can have the same indicators for everyone to use in order to allow us to assess whether or not that approach is efficient. And we also need to see the restoration activities regarding the ecosystem services. We can use that to absorb carbon. We also need to assess the projects regarding coastal defense and food provision, etc. And you will be able to consult this in the European Union portal and also the projects portal that will be available for everyone. So what I wanted to tell you specifically regarding my presentation is the following. We have now started a new project following up on the previous one. So the one that I was telling you about is Rest Coast, and then we are starting Coastscapes from 25 to 29. It's a new project that is rethinking coastal landscapes with climate resilient measures. And the idea is to see how the restored ecosystems can allow us to be more resilient. And this is what we are going to do. We are going also to have pilot sites, and the Mediterranean is indeed well represented in this project. We have Ebro, Spain. We also have Venice Lagoon, and also in the Dark Sea. And we have some types of pilot sites. We have demonstration sites. We also have application sites that will, or replication sites that take what they learn in the pilot sites and then they apply it, and also the transfer sites so that what is learned can be replicated and transferred to outside of the European Union. And this is what we have been doing. I'm very happy to share with you what I have been doing. You have my email address. If you want to contact me, please feel free. Thank you very much for listening to me, and I hope that you have a rest of the day that is very fruitful. Thank you.
Between each of the three presentations, I propose that we have a coffee break between the presentations. So this was an amazing presentation. Thank you very much. And now we can have some time for questions and answers, 10 minutes maximum. So three or four questions to each of our speakers. And those Q&A moments are immediately after each presentation. So I would like to ask the members of the committee if you have any question to Nuno Caiola. Perhaps our national MEP, Paulo Nascimento Cabral, can kick off with not difficult but insightful questions. So I'll give the floor to Paulo Nascimento Cabral. Thank you very much, Chair. Being in Portugal and in Madeira, allow me to address you in Portuguese. First, I would like to thank Professor for presenting this very important study. This work has been conducted in many deltas of the Mediterranean and also outside of the Mediterranean. And what you presented us is, on the one hand, hopeful, because there is a new approach to deal with climate change, to deal with sea level rises, with coastal protection. It's a new way of addressing what has happened so far, because usually we fight against climate change by reinforcing the defenses in our coastal areas. And we know it's just a matter of time that those defenses will disappear. I come from the Azores, and we have had that experience. Whenever we reinforce our coastal areas, sooner or later, the sea will destroy those protections. So, of course, the situation of violence is different from mainland areas, but we try to play with the different dynamics of the sea, and in this case, the sea level rises. What you presented and all the studies show that the increase in sea levels creates a serious concern due to the destruction of biodiversity, the destruction of the resources that we have, but also with everything that is related to the construction of ports and accesses, maritime transport, which are now at a very difficult stage for supplying the Mediterranean areas. It is already very expensive and will become even more expensive with the need to adapt all the structures to face the increase in sea levels. Temperature increases also worry us significantly. Although the Mediterranean is just 1% of the sea area worldwide, it is where these changes are taking place more significantly. The loss of biomass is something that worries us significantly. Going straight to the point, besides the work that is being conducted, and we know that at the European Parliament, European Commission, we have one of the most ambitious environmental protection policies. I would like to ask you, which other measures could we take? Because we must understand that we are ambitious in terms of environmental adaptation, but we cannot lose competitiveness vis-a-vis the global economy. And we have that example with partners such as China that do not have such a vast environmental ambition, and they're economy is more competitive than ours. What else can we do at the European Parliament and European institutions, and how can we collaborate even further, especially in the Parliamentary Assembly of the Union for the Mediterranean? How can we cooperate as Europeans? How can we cooperate more with our neighbors from the Mediterranean so that we can have a good sustainable development strategy and a good resilience strategy regarding climate change? I would say that in terms of fisheries, we have good examples of cooperation, namely through an entity that is precisely, and I know the term in English, but I don't know it in Portuguese. It is the Commission for the Good Management of Mediterranean Marine Resources, GSCM, Global Fisheries Council of the Mediterranean. And so in that sense, this will be a good exercise where we manage jointly the fishing quotas. Would it be interesting to have such a cooperation at other levels, or what do you recommend? Thank you very much for your question. So, the question you're asking is indeed very relevant. It's about the balance between the actions we can undertake or maintaining the lifestyle that we are used to. I think that the main investment of the EU, and not only, is the development of adaptation strategies. because there are some things that are unstoppable, at least for the time being, especially in the sea. Adaptation is therefore very relevant. And so we think, and I think that we are in line with the European Union with the basis of the Green Deal, that there is a paradigm shift and that we need to start thinking about more sustainable solutions, not only at the environmental level, but also at the economic level. And for that, I think that working with nature is cheaper. And in the near future, it is also more sustainable. And I think that this is something that everyone takes for granted. And we are also working towards improving the ability that some ecosystems have to store excessive carbon. But that is not enough. Mitigation, the true mitigation of climate change through emission reduction, is paramount. It is absolutely necessary, especially in the marine environment. Even if overnight we would stop emissions altogether and we would have negative emissions, most likely the effect would be more or less quickly seen in the air temperature. But the oceans, the sea that has much bigger thermal energy, would continue to warm. And most likely, the effects of this warming in the sea level rise would still be seen until the end of the century. But we have to do something right away. Honestly, I think that the European Union as such is doing its own work. But somehow, I think that the European Union should be brave regarding some of its partners. Because this is absolutely necessary. We need to reduce emissions. We should have zero emissions or even negative emissions. That is absolutely necessary if we want to maintain our lifestyle, especially in coastal areas. Besides that, there's something that I haven't said. In many of the coastal areas of the Mediterranean, for example, the deltas, adding to the sea level rise, we also have subsidence, which is the terrain that subsides. Given the characteristics of the soil in these sandy areas, especially in the deltas, the weight of the terrain makes it sink at a rate of 5 millimeters per year. In one of those tables, I told you that sea level rise was also more or less 5 millimeters per year. So in these coastal areas, we are talking about a relative sea level rise of 1 centimeter per year. So it's the double of the effects that we are expecting. If we are forecasting a sea level rise by 2100 that can reach a meter, in these areas it can almost reach 2 meters, and that will be the end of everything. This creates a very difficult situation, and therefore we need to be brave. Thank you very much. I'll give the floor to the delegation of Cyprus to Member of Parliament Averof Neofitu.
That every individual, every community, every city, every nation, and the Europe must do its best for the protection of the environment. But we have also to consider how effective we'll be in protecting our marine and natural environment if China does not follow the same rules, if America doesn't imply this right policy for the protection, and India and all these great manufacturing countries. Besides the European policies, I believe that Europe has to take an initiative for an international policy for protection of the environment. Thank you.
I mean, thank you. Thank you very much. And I couldn't agree more with you. I totally agree with you. But first of all, let me say that I'm a researcher. I'm a professor. I'm not a politician. I don't want to be a politician. but yeah, I mean, I said something like this to the previous in the previous question, and I believe so. But I think that we Europeans, we have the opportunity, but also that we can be the leaders in this movement of trying to adapt and to mitigate climate change, not only at an environmental level and biodiversity level. Of course, these are very, very, very important issues, but also to do so by being sustainable and by taking into account the needs of our people and the lifestyle of our people and the economy of our states. So, and this is a great deal, but we have to do something. We are doing something. And in this case, I really think that the European Union has a very, very good opportunity to take the lead.
Thank you very much. I don't think we have any more questions. And so I'll give the floor to our distinguished guest. Thank you very much, Nuno. So I'll give the floor to our distinguished guest, Director, Head of the Mediterranean Institute for Environmental Studies, a Senior Research Associate at the Science and Research Center, COPPER. I'll give the floor to Madam Yeneia Penka. Thank you very much for the contribution you will give us. So we will have 20 minutes for the initial presentation and then a question and answers period. Then we will break. We will have a short coffee break before the last expert presentation.
Thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm really delighted to be with you and talking to you, but also with you, hopefully, foremost with you today. The science that I'm engaged in is all about action. I'm a social scientist and I work with environmental issues. We are, so decision makers in all their forms are a key primary target group for us. So I'm really, really thankful for the opportunity and looking forward to our discussions. I was invited by the organizers to talk about the governance aspects of the thematic of today's meeting, which is protecting wildlife and addressing the degradation of terrestrial and marine ecosystems in the Mediterranean region. And I've rephrased my task into how can we accomplish this goal. I will be taking off where the previous speaker left it a little bit, but I think we have also entered this actionable area a little bit. But these are my starting points, that status of nature, and I'm putting nature in italics because we're talking about biodiversity and the broader ecosystem services that we get from the biodiversity, has been declining and is at critical stage. My starting point is also that governance, in the sense of institutions, norms, and processes, can be effective. And we need to be addressing multiple environmental challenges at once, but not only environmental challenges, also social challenges, which is also what we have been talking about in the past minutes, and the time is now. And this will not be a presentation only of my own work. I will be drawing largely on large-scale synthesis of knowledge that has been going on in two international panels or bodies, the first one being the Intergovernmental Panel for Biodiversity and Ecosystem Services, or IPBES, which has, at the end of 2024, produced two large assessments. One was on transformative change, and the other one was on Ixus. And the other body is Mediterranean Experts on Climate and Environmental Change, in particularly, again, 2024, a report on the WEF and Ixus in the Mediterranean basin. So these are the reports that I'll be talking about, and I do realize that you can't see the titles from behind, so I'll just read them out. The first one is the thematic assessment report on the underlying causes of biodiversity loss and the determinants of transformative change and options for achieving the 2050 vision for biodiversity. The second IPBES assessment report is on the interlinkages among biodiversity, water, food, and health. And the MEDEC report is on the interlinking climate change with the water, energy, food, and ecosystems in the Mediterranean. And you will see that the two Nexus assessments have a slightly different thematic foci. So one talks about biodiversity, water, food, and health, and the other one about energy, food, ecosystems, and water. But essentially, the messages that are coming out, like, let's say the, at least the overarching messages, are very much aligned. And I've tried to be succinct in my presentation, realizing that you come from very diverse contexts in your positions, very diverse geographic, cultural, and so on. And I try to offer messages that are relevant for all. The key message will be that we are looking at transformative change, which is necessary, urgent, and challenging, but possible. Different systems, whether we talk about climate change, water, biodiversity, food, and health, or we talk about energy, water, biodiversity, all these systems or elements of the nexus are interconnected. And we are increasingly talking about polycrisis, in the sense that we can't talk about climate crisis only, we can't talk about biodiversity crisis, because they both are interrelated. And moreover, there's also, of course, the pollution that we've known for perhaps even longer about, pollution of air and water. And all environmental crises are also interconnected with inequality, social inequality, inequality of access, inequality in terms of benefits that we get from the nature. And so this is the first message, that global crises are interconnected and that biodiversity loss stands at the core of it, so that the projected collapse of key ecosystem functions and biodiversity loss are closely interrelated. Over the past decades, we have been intensifying pressures on both the direct drivers and indirect drivers of biodiversity loss. And we're now essentially trying to, what I believe the last figure on the right really shows very neatly, is that we're just trying to reverse the curve or stabilize it. But instead, the business as usual scenario is just continuing on the trend that we have established many decades ago. Both Nexus assessment reports, so both from MEDEC and IPBES, have gone into great depth about how the continuation of current trends on direct and indirect drivers will result in substantial negative outcomes for all the subsystems that we're talking about. And that they also have highlighted without doubt that scenarios that prioritize a single element, so something that only focuses on a measure that only focuses on protecting a forest from invasive species, or if we're only protecting a system from climate, leads to then trade-offs across the nexus. So it is really not very wise to be focusing on one element. What has been particularly upsetting for us as social scientists is that governance of biodiversity has not been able to prevent the decline of biodiversity. And I think that's a very powerful message. So we have had over the past decades increasing number of efforts. We have had more and more multilateral environmental agreements. We have had better participation in them. We're putting more efforts into producing scientific synthesis knowledge from these efforts. We are having a lot more publications on the matter. So all of these efforts have been going up, but all the indicators of biodiversity health have been going in the opposite direction. So the axis graph that you see above is really something that should wake us up. What we have done in the past years as a scientific community is that we have gone from talking about direct drivers and also indirect drivers of biodiversity loss and loss in also pressures on climate change and so on, into looking at the underlying causes of this crisis, interrelated crisis. And in the transformative change assessment, we have specified three key underlying causes. And we have identified them as disconnection from and domination over nature and people, concentration of power and wealth, and prioritization of short-term individual and material gains. And our findings that come from many thousands of sources of literature show that these underlying causes are deeply rooted and interconnected social and cultural patterns that shape, influence, and reinforce all direct and indirect drivers of biodiversity loss. So they manifest in the ways we perceive nature, they manifest in the ways we deal with nature or in the ways that we practice our views, and also in the ways that we structure our societies. And we call this, in short, as views, structures, and practices are stifled by these underlying causes of biodiversity loss. So transformative change for a just and sustainable world shifts these dominant views, structures, and practices in ways that address the underlying causes of biodiversity loss and nature's decline, and follow the principles of transformative change. And these principles are equity and justice, pluralism and inclusion, respectful and reciprocal human nature relationships, and adaptive learning and action. But we haven't gone as far as saying that everything needs to change. We realize that there are many very important and very much with transformative change aligned views, structures, and practices. So these should be and can be strengthened. And here I've pasted just some of the examples from the Mediterranean of practices that are very much aligned with the principles of transformative change. So one is the production of salt, and the other one, production of argan oil and associated products. Transformative change, of course, faces challenges that are systemic, persistent, and pervasive, which impede and prevent transformative change and reinforce the status quo. And the assessment has gone into depth in identifying these challenges. There are five of them. Relations of domination over nature in people. They are also economic and political inequalities. They are also inadequate policies and unfit institutions, unsustainable consumption and production patterns, and limited access to clean technologies and uncoordinated knowledge and innovation systems. And we could be talking about each of these barriers in greater length, but this is just a summary of what you can then find in the assessment reports, and particularly the summary for policymakers. But the area that I do want to spend a little bit more time on is the strategies that have a potential to advance transformative change. And they are each of these five strategies that I'll just mention here also have a lot more proposed actions. So the assessment does try to be a lot more operational and tangible for people such as you, but also others. Strategy number one is conservation that involves sustainable stewardship, notably by indigenous peoples and local communities, where it is inclusive, well-resourced, focused on places of high value to nature and people, and when the rights of indigenous peoples are recognized. Strategy number two, transformative changes in so these are promising strategies that we should be looking at, is transformative changes in sectors that heavily contribute to biodiversity loss, including agriculture and livestock, fisheries, forestry, infrastructure, mining and fossil fuel sectors delivering social benefits. Strategy number three is transforming dominant economic and financial paradigms so they can prioritize nature and social equity over private interests. And this figure is really quite telling. It shows that more than half of the global GDP that we, of global GDP, is actually highly dependent on nature. Externalities of sectors most responsible for nature decline are very large, but what we invest in nature is only a small portion of that. And I'd like to dwell on this point, and perhaps I'll elaborate more if I've got time later. I think I'd like to come back to this point in engaging in the discussion that was opened earlier about what more the EU can do. And we would be returning to this, but allow me to do so at the end. Strategy four is inclusive, accountable, and adaptive governance systems involving diverse stakeholders in decision-making and addressing governance challenges. And the last strategy is shifting dominant societal views and values to recognize and prioritize human nature interconnectedness. And this can be done inter alia through changing cultural narratives, dominant social norms, facilitating transformative learning processes, ethics of care, and so on across systems. In the transformative change assessment, we haven't done what you might find very theoretical and abstract. We have also collected almost 400 cases of transformative change, and there is a database that has been coming out of that effort. And we have performed an analysis of the database. These efforts are coming from very diverse contexts, from small scale, large scales, public policies, but also bottom-up initiatives. And some of the very quick results that I can share is that positive outcomes have been evidenced within a decade or less. So actually the results do pay off in a rather not short, but maybe midterm. And they come, the results come or benefits come for a diverse set of social, economic, and environmental indicators, which you can see in the panels B and C. Transformative change is systems-wide, and so we do really need what we call whole-of-government approach or the quadruple helix approach, or there are so many labels for this. But essentially, all actors and sectors, from the public, business sectors, from the non-government sectors, academic, and so on, have a role to play in transformative change. Both small-scale and large-scale changes contribute to transformative change for a just and sustainable world when they address the underlying causes of biodiversity loss and nature's decline. And there are different actor groups, but what we have found that it's not the important thing is not the actor groups, it's the collaboration between these different actor groups that lead to best performance in different measures. An important element is also are also shared positive visions of future. So when we know where we're going, this can have a really stimulating effect for the decision makers. And here I have collated some of the powerful opportunities for governments to foster transformative change, and opportunities are focusing on policy coherence, smarter regulations to benefit nature and nature's contribution to people through diverse array of measures from policies, plans, regulations, taxes, fees, permits, financial and fiscal tools. They also relate to eliminating, phasing out, or reforming environmentally harmful subsidies. Of course, promoting international cooperation, which is also what we're doing in this meeting, and coordinating with business and private sector initiatives and their tools. Social movements play a crucial role, and they can be found, of course, all across the globe, but unfortunately, a lot of civil society initiatives and environmental defenders do face violence and rights. This is also a measure that should not be forgotten, so putting them under defense, putting more attention on defense of environmental defenders. And coming back to the Nexus assessment, response options that are implemented together or in sequence may then enhance the Nexus-wide benefits. So if we look at different measures that protect different elements of the Nexus, this brings more benefits for other Nexus subsystems as well. And needless to say that these response options do go in the direction that also governments have agreed to, from the Sustainable Development Goals to the Kunming-Montreal Biodiversity Framework, Paris Agreement, and so on. So addressing multiple international commitments together is important. More on different response options, I would say, can be found in the assessment, and I wouldn't like to overload you with information at this stage. Instead, I would like to summarize what the assessments have done. I believe they have jointly provided decision makers with the best available evidence on transformative change and the interlinkages among systems and sectors. These assessments provide guidance on how economic financing and governance systems can transform and how governance is to be conducted. And they recognize and emphasize the role for all actors in addressing global crisis. And they inform and call for more integrated decisions and actions to support international commitments. And these are my very succinct takeaway messages, but mostly I would like to really throw the ball back to you, and I'm really looking forward to the conversation with you on where could you play an important role in ensuring a more just and sustainable future in your roles of decision makers. And I believe I should stop here in terms of time, but very happy to engage in the previous point or any other points. Thank you.
Muito obrigado, doutora. Fantástica intervenção também.
Thank you very much for your excellent presentation as well, which is very relevant for our political decision making in the different countries. We can now have a very short period of questions and answers. I would like to ask you if you have any questions or comments to what Professor Yeneya Penka said.
Ligação Turca, Montenegro, Bulgaria.
Delegations from Turkey, Montenegro, Bulgaria, everything was clear. Vanir Sush from the Portuguese Parliament. Good morning. First, I would like to greet the chair of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Union for the Mediterranean and all the delegates. It's an honor to welcome you all in the autonomous region of Madeira. As an elected member of the Legislative Assembly of the Madeira. I'm also a substitute member of this committee. I would like to thank our speaker, who focused on very important topics, because talking about the environment, biodiversity, and land and marine ecosystems is debating about a development model, a model of environmental sovereignty, intergenerational responsibility. And as was rightly said, it's important to have international cooperation. The European Union recognized the centrality by placing sustainability at the center of political action. We have the European Green Deal, the European Strategy for Biodiversity for 2030, the Natura 2000 Network, nature protection, integrated policies for the oceans, sustainable fisheries, and the fight against marine pollution. So all these policies are based in a clear principle that there is no strong economy without healthy ecosystems, and we cannot have a credible climate transition without an effective protection of biodiversity. And therefore, Portugal is a maritime and Atlantic country with one of the largest exclusive economic zones of Europe, has an added responsibility in protecting land ecosystems. And it's also an opportunity to different levels, an opportunity that European countries cannot waste. And so my question is, I would like to know how do you think that current international conventions and regional strategies that have been adopted to protect biodiversity of the Mediterranean are effective? We have heard about climate change, the warming of waters, the increase in sea levels, the droughts that are accelerating. And we all think about structured public policies. And I would like to know, being in the autonomous region of Madeira, which are the specific vulnerabilities of peripheral and island regions that should be considered in the European policies to fight against climate change and protect biodiversity. Thank you very much, Madam Member of Parliament. This amazing thank you for mentioning the importance of this region, the autonomous region of the Madeira. And I'll give the floor to the Member of Parliament of the Turkish Parliament, and also a member of the delegation of the Parliamentary Assembly for Turkey.
Çok teşekkür ediyorum Sayın Başkan.
Oh, well, I would like to speak after the coffee break, but nevertheless, I would like to congratulate the experts that we've heard. It was a very rich approach. I would like to suggest to Professor Nuno that maybe when you're older, you can be a politician. Because if we don't have politicians, all research will be useless. I'm also a professor, a teacher. And every publication and book, if politicians do not put their hands in the dough, if they do not work implementing the necessary policies for biodiversity and protection of wildlife, these policies will not bear fruit. So I suggest you consider politics in the future. Thank you for allowing me to speak, but I will speak later after the coffee break. Thank you very much. Yes, after the coffee break, there will be a moment for interventions of every member of the meeting. And after the presentation made by Mr. Pedro Sepulveda. If there are no more questions, well, there is a question by the European Parliament. Paulo Nascimento Cabral, you have the floor.
And forgive me the floor. Just a brief question. I was listening very carefully to this presentation. And indeed, I think it's quite critical or shows very strong criticism of what we are doing right now globally. And I understand this from one side. But on the other side, I have to tell you that in the European Union right now, we are facing with a huge, I will say, problem that we had a previous Vice President Timmermans that engaged with this very strong green agenda that we all believe is quite important to be ambitious, but at the same time we discovered that he was paying for the NGOs to pass his message instead of defending the environment. And this is the instrumentalization of the NGOs and civil society movements. For me, it's quite a critical issue. I think it went too far. It doesn't make any sense what we are doing. We were paying the NGOs, subsidizing the NGOs to pass idea of one member of the European Commission, the Vice President. And this, I think, it's completely unacceptable. So when I saw in our presentation that the civil society movements should take into account, I totally agree, but without this political instrumentalization. Secondly, you are totally right. I think globally we are not interlinked in our actions. And for instance, the European Union represents roughly 7% of the total GE, so gases, so gas effect stuff, greenhouse gases, so GHG. So we represent roughly 7% of the total emissions, and we have the most ambitious policies in all world. And this now is posing a huge problem for us, as you may know, and this creates or accentuates this societal diversity or I would say difficulties of development in our societies. The most vulnerable are getting behind exactly because of some of the measures that we have just did. For instance, when we are talking about the end of fossil fuels, that we agree, but we need to take it into a period that allows all of them to prepare for this transition. And this is why we created the Just Transition Fund. Unfortunately, it disappeared with the next proposal of the MFF from the European Commission. So, also, when we talked about the reindustrialization of the European Union, because we lost all our industry, because we delocated this industry for other countries that doesn't have so many requirements to comply with the development of their economies. So all of that created a very strong pressure on our economies and our society, and of course created this more, I will say, diverse or extreme position of the classes on society. So I think we need to work on it in order to achieve the sustainable development. But the sustainable development for me has to be founded or grounded in three pillars: environmental sustainability for sure, but also economic and social. Because if not, if we focus only in one of these pillars, I think it's a recipe for not doing anything, and we will have the population against our policies because they don't understand the added value of what we are doing. So thank you for your presentation. Thank you for your strong messages. But at the same time, I think that the message from here is how to engage other partners, globally speaking, into the same pattern that we are facing right now with the European Union, and at the same time, see if the measures that we are having right now are compatible with the other countries in the world. I prefer to maintain ours and bring them on board, but we cannot continue on this process because we will lose the capacity of our economies to react, and the society will be even poorer, and we'll have more groups of less developed or more disadvantaged people. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Paulo Nascimento Cabral, I'll give the floor to the speaker now for any comments or answers you want to give. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you very much. And I would like to thank all the members that have voiced very clear comments to the presentation. I really appreciate them. I think I gather that we all reiterate the importance of the environmental agenda as such. I think there is a very high consensus on that. But that we all hear the concern about how this is affecting the economy. And I think that came out quite clearly in various interventions. Now, these are, of course, also messages I hear from the context that I engage with. And I think then we all try to, in the area where we work, where we try to be actionable with our knowledge, we know that, what else, we ask, what else is it that we can do? And I think we, in science, has been in a little bit of a schizophrenic position, always giving more and more recommendations and only finding that none of them are really respected or heard or put into action. And I think likewise, environmental governance has been always going for higher and higher ambitions, only to find out that even the basic ones haven't been delivered on. So I think first, accepting this as a truth would be a very wise and healthy first step. And I hope we are doing a little bit of that on such factual checks. So setting perhaps lower ambitions and accomplishing them might be a transformative agenda in the first sense. Secondly, from the list of strategies that I outlined to you, I think one that we really do not pay attention to as a global community and as in this meeting and in other meetings where decision makers come together is the phasing out of subsidies that are harmful to the environment. I think this is, of course, a very difficult topic, and I think if we call it as such, it's at least the first step. But it is something that we really need to be engaging in before we then put ambitions in other areas. And so perhaps also as a European and a member of the country that's a member of the EU, we always come back to defend our environmental agenda and our environmental policies. But maybe we could be a little bit critical of the direction in which this has gone, and perhaps looking at what other harmful measures we can cut on before we implement newer goals. That would be my, let's say, at least starting point for discussion that, of course, is in the hands of other people than me. But yeah, happy to go into in-depth in more on other points later on. Thank you.
Muito obrigado.
Thank you very much, Professor Yeneia Penka, for your contribution. For your insightful contributions for future action. I'm very grateful for your presentation. I propose we have now a short coffee break. And then Professor Pedro Sepulveda will make his presentation after the coffee break. So we will have a 10 British minutes for a short coffee break offered by the Legislative Assembly of the Autonomous Region of Madeira. Thank you very much, and see you soon.